May 3rd, 2005, open a public hearing on SB 5513. Mr. Bender.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Today you start three more days of Phase 2 hearings on the Department of Higher Education budget. And in order to start things out, I would ask you to look at a couple handouts that I've distributed to you. I've distributed a number of items, actually three items to you. The first is an item that has a big pie chart on the front. And that is what I would like to start out with. This will sort of explain the structure of the OUS budget, which is a fairly complex one, but I hope that this handout will be helpful in describing how the Oregon University System's budget is organized and how the state funds are used within that budget. So again, if I could ask you to look at this two-page handout here that has four pie charts on the first page and four pie charts on the second page. On the first page here, what this shows is the areas of the budget that contain what I would call the discretionary general fund dollars in them. By discretionary, I mean these are the amounts that are not really predetermined by other factors that we'll get to when we talk to the second page. But you'll see there are a number of items here, a number of pie charts and a number of boxes. Each of these boxes represents separate program areas of the OUS budget for which you provide line item appropriations. So OUS does not have authority to shift funds from any one of these boxes to another. Only you could do that. The largest of the program areas is called the Education and General Program. And what the Education and General Program finances is it finances what probably most people think of when they just think of what higher education does. That is to say, it finances the instructional programs, it finances the support for the research and the public service activities of the Chancellor's Office and the seven OUS campuses. This is approximately, all of these numbers here represent, on this first page, represent amounts in the governor's recommended budget. And the governor's recommended budget includes about $2.9 billion for these education and general activities. And the fund sources are shown in this pie chart. Blue represents the general fund. There's no lottery fund actually in the ENG budget, but I've combined general and lottery funds since they're both sources of state monies into one color there that's blue. And you can see that about $549 million is in the governor's budget for ENG, which represents 19% of the funds. In the red, the two colors, two shades of red, these are what we call other funds limited. And other funds limited consist of a number of sources, or come from a number of sources, but the primary source, which is in the darker of the red slices, are the tuition and fee dollars that the students are paying. So that represents most of the other funds limited. As you can see, the amount that students would pay under the governor's budget of $842 million is, you know, a good deal in excess of what the general fund amount is of $549 million. And they represent about 30% of the support. Another 6% comes from other limited funds that come from a variety of sources. One of the primary sources of these, that $179 million, would be what we call indirect cost recoveries, which are amounts that are awarded primarily under federal grants that the institutions are allowed to use to help support their infrastructure. These are called indirect cost recoveries. That's a large amount there. There are other items in that $179 million, including sales and services income, some interest income. But altogether, there's another $179 million that comes from these other sources. The thing I would like to stress about this pie chart is that the way OUS operates and the way that the institutions finance their expenditures is that the blue and the red dollars are combined. These are just various sources of funds that the that the seven institutions and the Chancellor's Office then use to finance their education and general program obligations. And this is combined, we call this the Education in General Limited Budget. The total amount, I don't have a dollar amount there, but in the governor's budget, the total amount of that education and general limited dollars is, it's about 1,500. Let me, I may have that somewhere else here. Yes, it's $1.57 billion. Now, the remainder that is shown in yellow there as non-limited is 45% of all expenditures in the education and general budget. But by non-limited, it means that the state, that you do not indicate or limit how many dollars can be spent out of these particular program areas. If OUS has the funds coming in from some revenue source, they can spend them without limitation. So the question is, well, what kind of funds, what are we talking about here that can be spent in this manner? There are a number of sources of education in general, non-limited funds. One of the primary sources is the grant activities, the federal grants that OUS faculty are being awarded. Those funds are non-limited in the budget. So except for the part that is transferred as indirect cost recoveries to support the infrastructure, the amount that's used as the direct costs for the research are non-limited. There are other non-limited funds in there as well. For example, certain student aid dollars are non-limited. So if there are student aid and student grants and loans are being supported and they're actually going through the OUS budgets because they're being used to pay for part of the tuition and fees, those dollar amounts are non-limited. If there aren't any questions, I just wanted to then point out the other three program areas here. I've tried to show by the size of the pie sort of the relative amounts of dollars that are in these various programs. And these are not exact. These are just conceptually, I mean, the sizes are not really accurate in comparison to each other. But you can see there are three smaller program areas. These are known as the statewide combined. These are the statewide public services that are operated by Oregon State University. And these public service programs provide services to the public and also support research in agriculture and forest areas and natural resource areas. These budgets also have a blue and a red, which are combined. The blue is general fund, and you can see the general fund amounts in the three budgets. The red are other fund dollars that are combined with the general fund, just as they are in E&G, to support the operations of these three public service programs. Unlike in E&G, there is no tuition or almost no tuition dollars at all in any of these three public service programs because these don't include the regular education programs for which tuition dollars are collected. But for the Agricultural Experiment Station and the Extension Service, the red dollars include federal funds that are provided by the federal government on a formula basis. So they're distributed to the states by formula. They also, for the Extension Service, a very large component of those red dollars are the funds that the county contributes to the operations of the Extension Service. The Extension Service is a cooperative operation between the state, the counties, and the feds. The non-limited amounts in all three of these budgets are primarily research grants that are awarded on a competitive basis, that the faculty go out and compete for and are awarded. On the second page here are four remaining program areas in which dollars are spent. On the upper left-hand side, you can see debt service. Debt service does have a significant amount of general fund in it, about $37 million. But I would argue this is not discretionary. You really have to pay it. It's just bills that are coming due, and that's the amount of what the bills that will be due this biennium that need to be paid by general and lottery funds. This is debt service on Article 11G and lottery bonds that were issued in prior biennia to support capital projects in OUS. The yellow, non-limited, these are primarily debt service on Article 11F1 bonds, which are bonds that the campuses support out of their auxiliary activities. Capital construction includes 5% general fund in the governor's budget and 95% other funds limited. These other funds limited for capital construction include bond proceeds. So these are the proceeds of bonds that are issued for capital construction projects. They also include gifts and grants. Typically, gifts and grants are not limited in the budget. And when a gift is given that's not for a capital project, it shows up in the non-limited E&G number on the first page. But when a gift is given for to construct something or to repair a facility, it becomes capital construction, and all of those gifts are limited. So the institutions cannot spend all of the gift money that they receive for capital construction projects unless you approve those on a project-by-project basis. So it's not done overall. It's done by each project. Then there's the Sports Action Lottery, which receives lottery fund dollars, $5.6 million. This, again, is not discretionary in the sense that under law, all of these funds are dedicated. The amount of the funds are determined by the sales of the sports action lottery games, or the returns on the sports action lottery games. And all of these funds are dedicated to sports action lottery. So really, in this budget, you have no control over the use of these funds. You can limit them and say you can't spend all of them, you have to build up a reserve or what have you, but you would need a substantive bill if you wanted to change the use of those monies. And then finally, there's a large area on the lower right, other funds non-limited, which is almost $1 billion, and this represents the activities of the auxiliaries of the Oregon University System, those particular entities that operate basically on a quasi-business sense, in the sense that they're supposed to generate all of the revenues of the costs of operating them. There is no state support for them. And the types of activities that are included in these other funds, non-limited, include housing services, dining services, parking, student health services, student government activities. All of these are non-limited in the budget. So this is the basic layout of the budget.
Yes.
Senator, back to your debt service, could you expand just a little bit on that yellow 104.74% one there?
Debt service, a number of projects are financed in the Oregon University System by what are known as Article 11 F1 bonds, which is the title of the Oregon Constitution that authorizes them to be issued. When an Article 11 F1 bond is issued for a project, the debt service on that project is not financed out of the general fund, but is financed from certain identified revenue sources for the project. The Article of the Constitution requires that these bonds can only be issued for projects that are self-financing. So an example of the primary example would be something like a new residence hall, where the source of the debt service would be from the residence hall fees. Part of those fees would be used to pay off the bonds. Other activities would include like student activity centers or student centers, where the student activity fee would be used to pay off the debt service on those bonds.
So the funding to pay those off would come from your fourth graph over here.
Yes.
The service is not limited.
Yes.
Thank you.
I mean, those are the activities that generate the funds for that, and that's why they're non-limited. The next page of this handout, which unfortunately is labeled 1, it isn't page 1, but this is the one that just shows a list of what the governor included as additions and subtractions from the base budget In terms of general fund packages, there are a number of other packages that don't involve general fund that are not listed here and will be discussed as we go through the budget. But these are the primary additions or subtractions that the governor has in terms of general fund. And I don't know if we have time really to go through all of these unless you have specific questions. But you can see there are some cuts in E&G, that last line, that the minus 14.8. There are other fund shifts. There are cuts to public statewide public service programs. Those are the things in red. There are some additions. The biggest addition in terms of dollars is $5.4 million in general fund for a capital construction project at in Medford. You can see there the House and the Senate co-chair adjustments. In terms of what the difference between the House and the Senate co-chair versions, they're very small for this particular budget, unlike OHSU, for example, where the House and Senate versions were quite different from each other. In this case, both co-chairs have versions which are quite similar to each other. And the bottom line, they're only about $500,000 off out of a budget of this size.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Wisman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bender, in your analysis that you provided us, in next to the last... I guess it's the last sentence in Education General Services. You say you believe that approximately $29 million is actually done. Can you comment on that text there, please? Expand on your thoughts.
The question is, how much would be required in order to allow OUS Education and General Services to maintain its existing level of programs? And as you can see, there are a number of cuts here, but there are also situations where the amount of general fund that was used to support various costs was changed in the governor's budget and shifted to other fund sources. And as a result of that, the number or the amount that we see here as being on the page that has the list of cuts and the total amount that's needed to support the ongoing programs are not identical. We could get into that, and that would take, I don't know to what extent you want me to go into that at this point in time.
I think, Mr. Chair, yeah. Follow up. I think, you know, your comment is you think that they need $29 million above the governor's to be at essential funding level, but then the $15 million, that's then you went to the 15.5 is where I'm, but only 50 is actually reduced from the level needed. So
let me reread that sentence. I haven't read that sentence for a while.
Oh, I know the first page here of this. Oh, this is this where we're at.
Yeah.
Okay.
The last sentence in the paragraph under education.
It has to do with the fact that technically there's a $15.5 million reduction from the amount that the is necessary to support E&G. If you go through the policy packages, you'll see that there's $15.5 million taken out. But if you wanted to maintain the same fund shifts that, or the fund splits that had been existing in 03-05, that the institutions were actually spending, then you would need more general fund, because what the budget does is it restores the fund splits that the legislature approved last session. That's what the governor did, as opposed to the fund shift, the fund splits that were actually spent last session. And those two things were different, and I think I have a graph that will show partially why those two things are different.
So, Mr. Chair,
yes.
Follow up. So, but Mr. Bender, would you say still that the governor's budget was $29 million under essential level?
Yeah.
And it looks the co-chairs have added 23 back. So,
But I think an adjustment to that, the co-chairs have added 23 back. But they've added it by a lot of it by freezing tuition, which might actually raise the overall costs, because you're not offsetting the increased costs now with increased tuition. So it's not like it's It's not like it's being...
Should we go on? We're going to get more into this later, Mr. Chair.
Some of this,
yeah. Yeah, we'll get more of it, but if you have any additional, please ask. And
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
It seems this thing didn't include the extension service. Wasn't that
That's correct.
Oversight?
This is just ENG.
This is this, but it doesn't... I mean, what I had heard at some point or other, that the statewide services, somehow the co-chairs had left out the extension as part of the formula. Is that a correct statement?
Well, I think that what the co-chairs did was they looked at the reduction to... there was no particular reduction to the extension service beyond what was involved in shifting some of the costs onto their other funds. So the co-chair's budget did not include any particular add-back for that. But as we'll see when we look at the extension service budget, they really don't have enough of these other funds to finance the full amount of that shift. So there is a problem there in their budget.
What I'd heard today is like the tuition's a big issue, the salary issue is an issue, and the extension. Those are the three things that I'd heard were kind of floating out there that we need to really look at. So.
Mr. Bender, can you clarify one item here and the significance of it? The Restore Information Technology funding was certificate of participation. The co-chairs have removed that from the governor's budget in both cases.
Yes.
What's the significance of that funding?
First of all, the reason why that the governor added that funding was that a certain amount of the base budget of higher ed that's been carried forward from biennium to biennium includes funding for ongoing information technology costs. As you can imagine, the systems have a lot of these costs on an ongoing basis. Last session, as a one-time shift in order to help balance the budget, the general fund was reduced by $5 million and replaced by certificates of participation to allow debt finance of some of the IT systems. That was only envisioned as a one-time shift, and the governor then restored the funding back to general fund.
Would that be debt service for the normal operational costs of the IT system in terms of upgrades that shouldn't be really considered
capital?
It's
not debt service. It's actually expenses for the upkeep and the upgrading of the information.
But the certificates of participation would be debt service.
The certificates of participation are creating debt service, and that debt service is covered in the budget. In the governor's budget, because this was a one-time thing, and the governor decided to restore the general fund, as had traditionally been the case, so that we wouldn't keep having more debt service. We just pay for it as it was needed.
Okay.
But these funds were eliminated by both the House and the Senate co-chair in an attempt to balance the budget and to deal with issues throughout the budget that needed additional funding.
That's undone. Where are we at now?
I just wanted to go to this chart, this bar chart, to show in the left, on the solid colored bars, this is history, and to the right are four proposed alternative budgets for 2005-07. If you look at the history and you look at the dark blue, you can see the decline. This is the general fund. In ENG only. We're only looking at education in general here. You can see that the state has been eliminating general fund over these three biennia. 1999-01 actually was the year that there was a big increase over the prior biennium, but since then there has been a reduction in general fund support for education in general programs. If you want to see, though, what's been happening in terms of how much money is available to support these programs, you have to, these are the same blue and red colors that we looked at on the pie chart, you have to add the other funds limited to see what's going on. And when you add the other funds limited and look at the sum of those two, you can see there's been an increase and not a decrease, which is to say that increases in other funds have more than offset the reduction in general funds over this period of time, and therefore have allowed an increase in total funding for financing the ENG operations. And the numbers there that you see between the first and the second bar, 7.9%, that shows there was a 7.9% increase in total funding in 01-03, even though the general fund dropped. If you look at the, there are two percentages between the second bar and the third bar. This shows what has happened in this current biennium that we're in now. The 15.8% shows that the legislative budget actually approved a 15.8% increase in expenditures this biennium over the prior biennium, even though general fund was going down. And that, of course, was financed primarily through quite significant tuition increases. So there was a level that was approved that was a 15.8% increase. But you see a number at the top, $63.7 million. These are approved expenditures that are not going to be spent. When it comes to other funds, what you do is you limit. That's the limitation. You tell them the maximum they can spend. And it turns out that they're not going to be spending all that you authorized them to spend. They're going to be spending an estimated $64 million less. And there are a number of reasons for that. Part of the reasons are they have less money than they thought they would have because the tuitions haven't generated as much money. Enrollments have been less than anticipated. And some of the tuition rate increases were cut back a bit. They weren't imposed at the levels that were originally anticipated. But also, there have been reductions in expenditures that even exceed the reductions in revenues. They've been cutting back their expenditures, and the total amount that's being spent out of these other funds is just the $927 million. Mm-hmm. So if you compare what they're actually spending as opposed to what they were authorized to spend, it's an 11% increase from the prior biennium, not the 15.8% that you allowed them to spend. And this representative starts to get to some of the issues of, well, the splits between weren't what we approved because they didn't end up spending as much of these other funds as they were authorized to. Then you can see four different alternative budgets that are proposed. And all of these percentages, whether you see 6.8, 12.4, 11.7, or 12.0, represent what this budget, if it were approved, would be an increase over the current 03-05. So like this would compare to the 11% that we've seen this time. You could see, for example, both co-chairs' budgets are about a 12% increase. So it's roughly, you know, the same rate of growth as we've had this time. If you look at the numbers in the governor's recommended budget, which are the numbers that were on this sheet and the numbers we've been talking about, those are the two numbers, the 548.9, you can see it on the pie chart, the 1021.1, that would be the sum of those two red numbers. That's the governor's revised budget. But next to it, I have something that I've called the 2005-07 adjusted budget. What the adjusted budget is it does represent the support that the governor has proposed, but it includes two things that are not in the actual numbers yet. And the two things that are included are there's additional general fund and there's additional other funds. If I can ask you to flip briefly to the next page, which is a chart, which is a table here. This shows the difference between the governor's revised budget numbers and the adjusted numbers on the prior page. The two things that the revised numbers include are $24.3 million in general fund for employee compensation increases. What this represents is the governor's budget has $130 million of general fund in it to support cost increases for employee compensation throughout state government. So this would support increases in benefits costs and or salaries. And it's just a dollar amount. And we estimate, it's not exactly known, but we estimate that the amount that would, that OUS would get of this, from this, would be $24.3 million. So really, the governor's budget has implicitly in it another roughly $24 million of general fund in support for OUS. So the adjusted budget includes that. The other thing the adjusted budget includes is $57.7 million for planned tuition increases. And by that, what we mean is, you'll hear when the governor, you know, when Mr. McGee presents his, the governor's budget, they will be talking about expectations that tuition would increase by, for resident undergraduates, about 7% the first year on average and 5% the second year of the biennium. There are also proposed increases for non-residents. And when you look at the overall rate of increase, it's smaller. It's about 5% overall for the first year and about 4% the second year. Although those tuition increases are supported, the other fund's limitation is really too low to allow all that money to be spent. But since the governor's budget supports those increases, it's presumably so that the monies can be spent. So I've added in the $57.7 million. Or to place it another way, if you wanted to just approve the governor's budget and say we're not going to make any changes, you'd need to increase the other fund's limitation to allow the tuition that's anticipated to actually be spent. Otherwise, they'd be limited and they wouldn't, the dollars would come in, but they would not be allowed legally to spend them. So that's the that number. And then the last two numbers show the House and Senate versions. And I show the adjustments here on this, in this chart here, of the House and Senate versions. The House and Senate adjustments, these are some of the adjustments from that prior table, but only the ones that apply to E and G, education in general. Note, if you look at these adjustments, if you look at the second to the last one, the resident undergraduate tuition freeze, that's a 33, this is in both the House and Senate versions, it's a 33.5% increase in general fund, but that's offset, you reduce the other funds by 33.5, because you're telling them you can't increase your tuitions, you can't generate the 33.5 that you were expecting from that tuition increase. So that represents an attempt by both co-chairs to shift the burden away from students a bit and to have the general fund support more of these E&G costs. And then finally, there's an employee compensation adjustment for the House version only. In the House co-chair's budget, the amount of...
Yes. I'm sorry, but can you explain, Mr. Bender, the difference between... If it was 57.5, but it's only 33.5, where's the other 22?
Graduate tuition, non-resident tuition.
Correct.
I didn't hear him. Oh, graduate tuition, non-resident tuition.
Thank you. Undergraduate, I see. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To follow up on that and the tuition freeze, we heard testimony last week, I believe it was, that a smaller tuition increase might be acceptable if we put more money into the opportunity grant. And have we done any calculations on what like a 2% plus 2% would be?
I believe that I did do that calculation, and my memory, which I should double check when I get back to the office, is I believe that would save the state, compared to what the co-chairs have, about $10.8 million or something like that, roughly.
Thanks.
So instead of it, yeah.
So we could shift that 10.8 to the opportunity grant.
Or whatever.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Nelson.
Just to follow up on that, I mean, what I'm hearing, and I need some clarification on this, is that basically the governor's budget gives more students access under the opportunity grant than co-chairs, either one's co-chairs budget. Is that a correct statement, or do I need more information on that?
I think that's a fairly accurate statement in terms of, I think I haven't discussed it with both co-chairs, but I believe that part of their IDN reductions would be to delay a portion of the expansion of the program to the second year and some other adjustments to it. There's another outstanding question there, though, and that is at the level of reduction in the co-chair's budget is whether or not we could keep all of the institutions that have students that receive opportunity grants in agreement on the distribution of those grants.
So we have an issue now.
We have an issue.
And the final element in the House co-chair budget is that the House co-chair budget takes 10% of the statewide compensation monies. They take $13 million out of $130 million to help rebalance their budget. That would have an impact on OUS of reducing their general fund by an estimated $2.4 million. So these are how we get the co-chair budget figures, which are on the prior chart. And that's all I have. I've got some information on campus finances, but there really is not time right now. We can get to that later if you're interested.
Thank you very much. Any additional questions at this point? Yes, Senator Woodson.
Chair Devin, Mr. Bender, it appears that the overall increase off the sheet here of available funding for OUHS is OUS is about $284 and a third million dollars, and yet we're only showing general fund designated increases of $24.3 million for increased employee compensation, and we're also seeing that the number of employees in the system is being reduced by roughly 700. There's some disparity there. I mean, is the employee compensation feeding off themselves and reducing the numbers? I mean, because $24 million obviously isn't going to cover the employee compensation increase of some 13,000 employees.
The anticipation is that the costs of financing, compensation cost increases, are covered by all of the fund sources here. The $24 million only represents for the education in general portion of the budget, and it only represents the part that would be financed by general fund. The rest of the cost increases would come out of the tuition dollars that are anticipated in the adjusted budgets or the co-chairs' budgets. So part of those funds or part of those costs increases are just as the costs are shared between those revenue sources, so are the cost increases shared between those revenue sources. And the $24 million is only supposed to support that portion of the total cost that is being covered by general fund. So it's only a portion of it.
Have you quantified, Mr. Chair, have you quantified the total increase, projected increase in employee compensation?
Yes. Yes. I'm not sure I have that number with me right now. I think I do, actually. Yeah.
That would be fine. Of course, part of that depends upon what agreement they reach, and even a modest adjustment in terms of what the governor's anticipated levels has huge impacts on the budget. Yeah. Senator Woodson, were you complete? Or?
I'm just
finished. Okay. Is it okay if I'll take Senator Nelson some... Well,
I'm just thinking at the other issue I'm hearing about is this faculty recruitment and retention. The governor budget puts in $1 million. House co-chairs takes it out.
Yeah.
And then the Senate has it back in.
Right.
So we have another issue there. I think we had a pretty thorough discussion of that one time about how important that was to be considering that.
Mr. McGee, while he is doing, while Mr. Bender is doing that, can you, do you have it?
I do.
Okay. Now, this is just for the university system, correct?
This is just for, actually, what I have right here is just for the education in general numbers. I don't have the whole system-wide, but the part that's comparable to that $24 million, if, and this, again, as the chair was very apt to mention, if we don't know exactly what the agreement will be, but if, essentially, there is a 2% salary increase each of the 2 years on average, and the expected benefit cost increases occur that we think are going to occur, the increase is approximately $96 million to pay for the additional costs in education in general limited. So under the governor's budget, there's about $24 million of that would come from general fund. The rest would have to come from the other limited revenue sources. So that's just the education in general limited budget portion.
So if I understand that right, Mr. Chair, then about $100 million of the $284 million increase would go just to the education part of it, and that does not include the increased salaries and benefits for all the other employees that work for Oregon University System. Is that correct?
On the $284 million, is that, that's the...
That's on the first page here, the difference between... That's the total increase.
Right. That would just go for a portion of the employees, yes.
Yeah. Thank you.
And Mr. Bender, in your figures, you were also including the single-step increase the governor has planned, were you not? Although that would not... That would apply to some university positions and not others.
That would be included. Yeah.
Okay. I think at this point we should probably go to Mr. McGee's presentation. And I'm going to make an adjustment in the schedule, actually, because I've just found out that the House is going into session at 10 o'clock. And so I'm going to go through Mr. McGee, Mr. Lorenzen, and the Chancellor. But I think the testimony, all that testimony is very important. But I think the items that are going to be covered by the the Assistant Chancellor are very important for the entire committee to hear. So I'm going to delay those till tomorrow. We have a lighter schedule on the remaining 2 days than we have today, but I'd like the entire committee to hear that testimony. So, Mr. McGee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Bill McGee from the Department of Administrative Services. I guess the one point in the conversation I would follow up is that, as Mr. Bender pointed out, we still have to negotiate a salary increase with SEIU. We haven't done that. We have to negotiate health insurance contracts with the providers, and we're still out for bid on that. So it really is very much unknown what those costs will look like. So, again, it's very speculative.
Mr. McGee, a clarification on that in terms of the contracts. We negotiated those. Sometimes we've had multiple year contracts. This is not the employee contracts, but the health care. Have we normally done those on a calendar year basis? So we would have basically 6 months into this next biennium that we still know what the costs are for or what the costs will be?
I'd have to check that to give you an accurate answer. I'll get back to you tomorrow.
Yes.
Mr. Carford, you said the contract you had negotiated with the SEIU.
On the salary increases.
On salary increases. And what was the second?
Well, we have to negotiate a contract with a health care provider for the compensation, or providers, plural. Yeah. Let's see, moving on to my presentation, and I will try to do this as quickly as I can. The second page gives you an indication of the size of the higher education budget within the context of the entire $11.7 billion that are in the education area. As you see, higher education here constitutes about 39% of the total education all funds budget, including both state general fund and all other types of federal funds. The following page shows you the breakdown of the education budget of just the general fund and the lottery fund budget of $6.5 million. And in that case, the higher education component now is 11%. Again, indicating, as Mr. Bender's slides have shown you, the very large amount of other revenue sources that flow into the higher education budget and kind of the reason why it is so complex. In terms of the governor's principals budget, very large agency, really fits into three. Most of it is in the education principal, as you'd expect. The research programs relate to the economic development principal, and many of the public service programs relate to the health principal. The next two pie charts are really contain the same information that Mr. Bender's eight pie charts did. They're only combined in slightly different ways to show you some different information. So there's a little bit perhaps less detail here. The first chart shows you for the entire $4.5 billion OUS proposal from the governor where the fund types come from. The general fund portion of this budget, about $685 million, constitutes 15%. That's, Mr. Bender indicated, the education general program, the OSU statewide programs, some debt service, and some of the capital construction budget. Lottery funds, 0.3%, or $12 million. Again, that's debt service and the lottery-backed bonds and the sports action lottery program. The other fund's limited component of the budget, $1.4 million, or 31%. Again, tuition fee revenues, the indirect cost recovery on grants that Mr. Bender talked about, bond proceeds and gifts and donations for construction projects. The other fund's non-limited, which agency-wide is about 54%, or $2.4 billion, includes the research funds that are donated, gifts and donations, the housing, dining, parking fees, the auxiliaries Mr. Bender talked about, and student aid funds. In terms of the different components of the budget, the ones you'll be actually taking action on as you go through your work session, education in general is the largest component of the budget, $2.8 million total funds, or 63% of the budget. That includes the instructional programs, student support, the operation of the universities, what we normally think is the largest part of the mission of the system. The three OSU statewide, the Agriculture Experiment Station at 2.9%, the Extension Service at 1.4%, and the Forest Research Laboratory at 0.8%. Other services non-limited, Mr. Bender again talked about those. Those are primarily the auxiliary funds, student aid funds, some other donations, gifts and grants that are restricted for different purposes. That's about 21% of the total agency budget. Debt service of $141 million on different bonds and certificates of participation, about 3% of the budget. The sports action lottery, $5.6 million, or 0.1%. And finally, the capital construction is 7.8%, or $355 million. Again, all total funds. The next chart shows you the category distribution of how the money is spent. About 44%, or $2 billion, is spent on personal services, the cost of individuals, faculty, administrators, staff, support staff, graduate student salaries, etc. Service and supplies, equipment, as well as the general service supply stuff we think about, is about $946 million, or 21%. Capital outlay, which includes the entire capital construction budget for the system, is $474, or 10% of total expenditures. And special payments, which are really student aid distributions, are about 22%, or $978 million of what the governor's recommending. The next page just gives you the numbers historically from the 99-01 biennium through the governor's budget, and includes some adjustments that we'll be talking about in a moment to what his original proposal was. In terms of the major policy issues, you've heard most of these, I think, numerous times. We have funding for 10 deferred maintenance projects at all of the campuses. This includes the OSU power plant, the cogeneration plant. This is $102.3 million. It's other funds, it's bonds, and other types of revenues. We have additional capital construction projects, 25 projects as a whole, that include the joint Southern Oregon University Rogue Community College facility in Medford. Also includes system-wide expenditures for general capital improvement repair issues that are often smaller than individual projects. That amount is $17.2 million general fund, 5.4 of that, as you know, is for the Medford facility, the rest is for general system-wide maintenance, and $235 million in is other funds. Some of this is Article 11 G bonds that would be, the debt of which would be paid with general fund. Majority of it is with donations and Article 11 F bonds that are self-supporting through housing, dining, athletic fees, whatever. We are recommending sale of certificates of participation, $20 million, other funds. This is separate from the issue you talked about before in the co-chair's budget. This would be new certificates of participation for various critical telecommunications and information system infrastructure at the campus. The largest piece is the telecommunications backbone at OSU, which is really the backbone of the entire system. So these are important projects that we are recommending you support with COPs. You've talked about, I think, the investments, the development of the pre-K data system before. You've seen that in the Department of Education's budget. You've seen that community college budget. The OUS portion of that is $2.2 million general fund. You've also talked about today the increased faculty compensation package, which would be $1 million general fund, to at least recognize the disparity in salaries between Oregon faculty and their peer institutions. The next slide, you talked, Mr. Bender talked about the governor's budget assumes tuition increases of 5 to 7% in the first year of the biennium and 5% in the second year of the biennium. We are proposing to phase out of the legislatively imposed cap on fee remissions. The cap on programmatic fee remissions we're proposing would be eliminated over two biennia. In 05-07, it would increase from the current 8% of tuition revenue to 10% and would be eliminated entirely in the 07-09 biennium. We're proposing completely eliminating the cap on graduate fee remissions beginning in the 05-07 biennium. There's a small piece to increase support for the Oregon State University Natural Resources Institute with funds that were freed up in some of the budgets from the natural resource agencies. There's a typo here. That should be $250,000 general fund rather than $100,000 general fund. Mr. Bender talked about the reductions in the budget. We do have reductions in all of the resource allocation model or the RAM line items, both the targeted programs and the enrollment-based programs. With the exceptions of the targeted programs that support the Cascades, the Bend campus, that was not reduced in the governor's budget. The supplemental funding for the four small campuses was also not reduced. And the funding that you approved last time for the nanotechnology signature research centers was also not reduced in the governor's budget. There are reductions in the Agriculture Experiment Station and the Forest Research Laboratory. We are proposing to use about $1.7 million of interest earning on bond funds to offset debt costs and reduce general funds in that way. You talked a little bit, Mr. Bender talked a little bit about adjustments in the essential budget level to correct fund splits and deal with some other issues. This reduced the general fund budget by about $26.8 million general fund and the total budget by $24.8 million total funds. These are issues of adjusting the fund split back to the fund split you approved in the last biennium, readjusting how the pension obligation bonds were split, how the PERS funds were split. And these were done in a policy package to highlight the changes, but what it means is the essential budget level, which you referred to in the past as current service level, really is not a good comparator because we believe it does overstate the general fund requirement by some amount. And I think Mr. Bender's discussion referred to that in his analysis that was referenced. There are a couple of issues that really affect the university system that are not in their budget, but I wanted to bring them to your attention as well. They are investments, and they're in the Economic Development Department's budget and are contained in Senate Bill 838 at this point. These would be the establishment of a commercialized research fund for $2 million lottery fund. These dollars would assist the university in bringing research ideas to the market. There is, I guess, something that's called a valley of death where between the development of a concept and the point where a private that venture capitalists will pick up something, there needs to be some investment to help bring those ideas to that point. We're also proposing to increase funding for the Oregon Nanoscience and Microtechnology Institute, or NAMI, an additional $7.7 million lottery funds there as well. As I indicated, we do have some adjustments, and I don't believe you've heard these before today. We'll talk really in two phases. One, I'm referring to governor's adjustments, and these are real policy changes. There'll be some technical adjustments I'll go through very quickly as well. In terms of the governor's adjustments and the operations side of the budget, we are proposing that you restore $2.8 million general fund.
Mr. McGee.
Yes.
Has the governor actually in his adjustments compiled them all within one document? Not just for this budget, but for others?
Mr. Chair, we have not.
You have not. Okay.
Continuing, we are recommending you restore $2.8 million and 13 full-time equivalent positions for the Chancellor's Office, the reductions we took in the Governor's budget. This would assist in improving the alignment with K-12 so we have a better fit as students moving from the high schools to the post-secondary system. Would enhance the accountability in the university system by adding to the audits division and some of the business and finance units, and to promote ongoing long-range planning efforts that's being carried out by the Higher Education Board. We have a couple of capital constructions issues. I know you'll spend more time on capital later, so I'll just highlight those quickly. The governor's budget had essentially a $2 million expenditure limitation for the College of Education project at the University of Oregon. We're now proposing that you fully fund that at $24 million in Article 11 G bonds and $24 million in other revenues. Two other projects, University of Oregon, that we're proposing you add that we didn't have in the governor's budget. One would be a Gilbert Hall project that would be $3.3 million in Article 11 G bonds and $3.3 million in gifts and donations. That would complete the development of the business school that I think you've seen on the campus in some of your visits. We're also proposing that you add a University of Oregon Theater Complex project. You've seen that before in different phases and approved some funding for that. To finalize that project, we're asking for another $3.3 million in Article 11 G bonds and $3.3 million in gifts and donations. And then also we're asking that you establish a limitation for the Oregon State University Apperson Hall project that would support the business and engineering schools. This will be entirely gift-driven, and we're asking you to establish that at $10 million other revenue proposal. And then finally, just very quickly on the technical adjustments in the budget, operations, we're proposing you increase positions in full-time equivalent by 362 to correct errors. I think Senator Wissett noted a decline in number of positions. We overstated those. We double-counted one reduction, and we simply left out a number of positions that should have been included. So the drop in positions is nowhere near as large as you saw from the original documents. We're asking that you shift $389 million essentially in lottery funds just among accounts to rectify exactly how the funds are spent. And we're also asking you to shift $5.2 million other funds non-limited to other funds limited for allocation of state government service charges. As we did our adjustment in the essential budget level, we took this piece of it a little too far. We have to back it off just based on what's allowable. A couple of small capital technical adjustments. We're asking you to increase the Reser Stadium and Parking Addition project by $4 million, Article 11 F1 bonds. Again, those are self-supporting bonds that we paid from revenue from that facility. Essentially, you know, the steel and concrete costs have gone through the roof, and we have to accommodate some additional costs there.
Are you sure they're going to need additional parking?
Pardon?
Just kidding.
if you go to the games, I guess. At the Oregon Institute of Technology, the Snell Hall project, there is $550,000, I believe, in FEMA funds that we're asking you to add to the project to help in the, I believe, in the seismic portions of that project. And in a very technical piece, we have to ask you to go back to the 2001-03 biennium and readjust some expenditure limitations to properly account for the OSU Nash Chiller project. There's no net increase in funding on that. It's just moving dollars from different accounts. And that concluded my presentation, Mr. Chair. Any questions?
Any questions, Ken or Nelson?
Yes, I'm on page 12 when you're going through the capital construction. I just talked about the project at Apperson Hall. That's a gift. My understanding that even some of the projects at U of O and maybe some of the other campuses also have matching gifts. Is that all part of it? But they're not all. They're not all fully funded. The one at OSU is fully funded entirely by gifts, and the one at the University of Oregon is that.
Mr. Chair, the OSU project would entirely be funded by gifts.
Okay.
The other three also have matching funds. It's a constitutional requirement to use Article 11G that you come up with some matching funds. In these cases, they're all gifts. 50% matching funds.
50%?
Yeah. The Gilbert Hall and the Theater Complex project, part of the reason we're bringing forward now is the university's raised all the matching funds. So we might as well move ahead with the complete projects. There's still a little fundraising to do on the College of Education, but that is moving along well, and we do anticipate that those funds will be in hand during the biennium to carry forward that project.
Okay. And another follow-up, sir?
Yes.
On page 9, we're talking about this pre-K through 12 data system, and this is just, I guess, sort of a pet peeve of mine that I'm developing what I'm seeing with the K through 12 data system is that they're not able to handle what they've got right now. And they've got all these reports. They got 61 reports that they're trying to figure out, and they don't have an analyst to even undertake what they're using, the data that they're bringing in. So, I mean, I have some problem with that, is how this is all going to come. It sounds good, it sounds nice, but...
Mr. Senator Nelson, there are two projects at the K-12 level, at the Department of Education budget. One is what they call really a vertical integration. It deals with the system that the K-12ers are using themselves. What you're seeing here is the other project, sort of the horizontal, which is really linking between the different systems. And as I understand it, what this will do, it will allow, when a student wants their records to be sent to the university or to a community college to be able to be evaluated for admission, that will automate that transmittal, so it won't require the high schools to do kind of paper materials the way many of them have to do now. And it will allow them to send a great deal more information on the student's progress in the high school level. And as explained to me, this will help the universities make good decisions in terms of the right admissions decisions on students. It will also help them tailor through the counseling and student support areas the type of assistance they give to the students once they're on campus. And I think the governor's included this project in these three budgets because of the belief that we really think we can have better outcomes for the students by proposing this system. So I understand you have some concerns, but I think we'd like to continue to have the dialogue on this system.
Thank you. Representative Jensen, are we done?
If I can follow, continue. How does the electronically transmitted data more enable the university to perform these services than the hard copy data that they're currently sending the university?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, as it's been explained to me, what the hard copy information is a very limited set of what the student's record is in their high school. That there is a great deal more information, that there just really isn't the time or the funds available for the high schools to really be able to deal with on a hard copy basis. And it will provide a great deal more information that the universities will be able to use both in admissions and counseling and student support.
And I think that goes back to Senator Nelson's question. If there's a great deal more information that's needed, that's more personnel time in gathering and inputting that information, even after we have spent the software money to bring this system up.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not the right person to fully describe it to, but my understanding is that a lot of that information is already entered. It's just a question of then to put it in hard copy and send it, whereas to actually transmit electronically becomes easier. So, but I'm sure they'll be able to talk to that as you've done for the hearings.
One of the benefits I see to the system, and it's going beyond the university system and community colleges, is the ability actually to track individual students rather than just simply saying that this year our test scores for third graders is this level and next year it's this level, is to be able to track an individual student. And, you know, if they're performing well in the eighth grade, to account for why they might be not performing well in the tenth grade if they show up as not performing well. And also the other thing that's not in here, and it's not part of this, is that the Department of Ed is getting closer and closer to having more students tested online, where teachers can actually get feedback on how the student is doing almost immediately, as opposed to testing a student and then having what used to be the old system, having things come back months later when you're well on into the year and not being able to meet the needs of the students. I think we'll have a further discussion of this because there's elements of this in literally half the budgets before us. So,
Mr. Chair,
yeah.
The one, and I've talked with the Oregon University system folks on this and have some degree of comfort with it, but
yeah.
The one word that I I caution us about is the terminology of track the students. One of the concerns I have with this is the Big Brother syndrome, if you wish.
Right.
And as I understand it, and we, as you indicate, I think we'll probably hear from them on this, but as I understand it, this data is transmitted to the universities or community colleges only at the request of the student. So the tracking is at student, basically, request of the data being sent.
Yes.
That there's a confidentiality issue that we need to be aware of and always on guard about, I think.
I agree with his, Representative Jensen, my understanding that the privacy requirements on student records, they're not probably quite to the level of HIPAA on health care, but they're close enough. Mr. McGee, did you have anything additional?
No, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Mr. Chancellor, would you want to come forward and we'll figure out what to do in the final 20 minutes we have? You do have a president here from Eastern Oregon University, and I don't think they're planning on being here for 3 days, probably.
Mr. Chair, with your indulgence, George Bernsteiner, Acting Chancellor, Oregon University System. Today we have not only the president of Eastern Oregon University, Hosra Fatemi, but we also have the chair of our board, Henry Lorenzen, both of whom join us from Eastern Oregon, and I would beg your indulgence to let them go next, if we may.
Okay, that sounds like a good proposal.
Thank you.
Mr. Lorenzen and Mr. Fatemi, please come forward.
Good morning, Chair Devlin, members of the subcommittee of Ways and Means. My name is Henry Lorenzen. I'm president of the State Board of Higher Education. I'm also a wheat farmer and a lawyer from Pendleton. I must say that being a lawyer allows me to be a wheat farmer.
Are all wheat farmers lawyers?
I think so. In order, it's either that or government farm programs that keep us going in the wheat business.
It's like you said, all lawyers produce chaff. So.
Yeah, I know. I open myself to this. But I want to thank you for allowing me to appear before you, and thank you for your hard work relating to higher education. Next slide. Slide, please. I want to bring you up to date on the work that we have done over the last year. It's been quite a tumultuous year. I found myself as president of this board after some very unusual circumstances, but our work went forward. And the principal work that we did was reorganizing the chancellor's office. And I'd like to talk about that today in particular. And the reason for that reorganization was to focus the efforts of the chancellor's office more on policy development, advocacy, and developing accountability systems, and to get us out of the business of gatekeeping and providing day-to-day services and medium-term services that we felt were best handled at the university level. So in other words, it was an effort to delegate to the extent appropriate and to the extent where efficiencies could be gained to the universities for many of these various important functions. As a result of this reorganization, this last year, we accomplished some very important things. First of all, through the great efforts of Gretchen Schulte, the president of Chemeketa Community College, who is also a member of the board, we developed what was referred to as the Oregon Transfer Module, by which credits earned at community colleges and at other universities can be transported as seamlessly as possible to other universities. This will be of great benefit to students in allowing them to understand and to anticipate what courses they can take at community colleges that will be directly transferable and to the university system. Also, Tim Nesbitt and Ann Pape spent a considerable amount of time, which included over 35 meetings around the state, dealing with issues of access and affordability, and it has paid dividends in the focus upon reinvestment in the Oregon Opportunity Grant. And finally, Kirby Dias's working group has developed and focused upon the areas of academic excellence and economic development. Now, the thing I'd like to focus on principally here, and something of which I'm quite proud, and I know there may have some controversy as a result of it, but through the reorganization of the Chancellor's Office, we have realized some $6 million of net savings. Now, the ultimate reduction in the Chancellor's budget is greater than that, and the reduction is from $26 million roughly to $13 million. The reason why it represents only $6 million in savings is that a number of the functions were transferred from the Chancellor's office to the universities themselves, which simply imposed the cost of those systems upon the universities. An example of this is the transfer of information technology. And this is something in which I had direct involvement. And in that particular circumstance, there were two computer systems located on the Oregon State University campus, both of which running similar programs. The one from the Chancellor's office was servicing the four regional universities plus providing data processing support for the Chancellor's office. Nearby was a computer system for Oregon State University running essentially the same programs, providing that service for Oregon State University. We combined those two systems into one, and the recurring savings will be $500,000 a year. That is part of the $1 million per biennium. We also essentially eliminated the academic affairs section, which, to a large extent, acted as a gatekeeper for various course programs offered at the university level. It was replaced by a provost council, whose responsibility is to review the undergraduate majors and programs offered. One of the benefits I've seen, and something of which I'm very proud, is I believe that we are now seeing among the major universities in particular, and also holds true for all universities, an unprecedented level of cooperation among the universities. I think it's been unheard of to see, the president of the University of Oregon and Oregon State embrace each other, both in terms of program offerings, how the schools can work together on an educational service basis. Also, simply socially, these two people have sponsored events for each other, and I think also the cooperation between universities is due in some not small part by the cooperation seen among the provosts in determining these course offerings. They have essentially replaced the academic affairs section within the Chancellor's office with a coordinating and cooperating body that has performed admirably well. And it's the proof of this is that they have not only brought forward very good programs for the board's approval, but they have also rejected a number, and they've taken their job very seriously. Now, I'd like to talk next about the use of the Chancellor's Office savings. The $6 million of savings has, first of all, been essentially used up in three areas under the budget as proposed. One, the Chancellor's Office has permanently allocated $1 million of the savings to the campuses. The governor's budget eliminated $4.7 million of that savings, used up $4.7 of it, and then the co-chair's budget proposes to use up another $700,000. Which leaves us in a hole. And as Don Blair, one of our board members, is a CFO of Nike, commented, he said that no good deed goes unpunished. And this is one of those situations where we very strongly believe that in refocusing the Chancellor's office, it was important to not only cut these positions that result and gain these efficiencies which resulted in the $6 million of savings, but it was also critically important to reinvest that saving in those areas that would allow us to carry out the functions that you folks and which the citizens want us to do, and namely, what I see important to develop and strengthen our auditing functions, our performance measurement functions, also our long-range planning ability, and also to strengthen our ability in areas relating to the association and work in coordination with community colleges and the K through 12. Your letter has been provided to you indicating how that reinvestment is proposed to work. And again, you know, this, if you look at it in terms of, you know, a reward for an attempt at efficiency, if we take the $6 million of savings and give us back half of that, roughly half of that, it would be a net benefit in terms of dollars of $3 million a biennium, and we'd also be able then to be able to carry forward with those most important programs in order to strengthen what I consider to be the most important role of the Chancellor's Office, which is developing those performance measures, accountability measures, and act truly as a central policy and a board. The thing that struck me, and I'll tell you, just digress for a moment, what struck me is both California, and I was looking on the internet, and Washington have very good comprehensive long-range plans which analyze the needs post-secondary, educational needs post-secondary of their citizens, and also a very careful analysis of what resources are necessary in order to meet those needs. Oregon doesn't have such a plan. I found it quite shocking that we don't have that available. This money, in my mind, that I consider probably the most significant aspect of our portion of it, is will provide us the opportunity to develop such a plan, which I consider absolutely critical in moving forward and analyzing what we need to do in higher education. Next slide, please. The reductions, just to further elaborate, they raise the concerns that we will not have the ability to meet the board initiatives, that they will impair our ability to refocus on policy and accountability and limit our progress on board initiatives. And then, as once again on the next slide, the restoration provide us with the opportunity to support our various working groups and to support what I consider to be one of the most important functions of the Chancellor's Office. And if you want to look overall at the $3 million savings, which would result even after the add back of the $2.8 million, represents an overall budget cut, an actual savings of 12% in the Chancellor's Office over what was spent in the last biennium. And again, you know, I just wish to stress that we worked very, very hard to analyze what our board considered to be the appropriate role of the Chancellor's Office. We relied heavily upon consultant reports that had been prepared in the past that had not been, whose work had not been followed or realized. And I believe, although there may be some controversy associated with it, through this reorganization, we have strengthened the university system. And in particular, if we can complete our task by reinvesting back into those areas of auditing, performance measurements, the development of performance measurements, the long-range planning, and funding the necessary staff positions to assure that we can integrate with community colleges and K through 12, we will be able to complete our task. That concludes my presentation, and I'll take any questions if you have them. Hopefully I'll be able to answer them.
I do have a question, and thank you very much for your presentation. We recently passed in the Senate, and I'm going to call on Senator Walker for her to help me with recalling the bill that requires the State Board of Education to get into a planning mode, strategic planning.
I can't remember the bill number.
Yes. Thank you very much.
We talked about that this morning, Mr. Lawrence and I.
Yes. Thank you very much. I wonder if you could address requirements in that bill and how it aligns, how that legislation aligns with the board's long-range planning efforts that are currently underway and will have some future focus.
I must confess I have not seen the wording of that particular bill, but also my response will be based upon what I anticipate it contains. I must say that I'm pleased to see that others recognize the importance of the long-range planning effort. I think that that bill does indicate also the Senate's strong desire that we engage in such a planning effort. Today we have been we have identified this as a critical effort on our part. We have not had the opportunity to spend the time on it yet. We have been very busy working with the budget. It's been a very, very busy year, with the work of the various work groups that we have established with the Chancellor's office. And this is the highest priority task as soon as we get through the budget process. Bottom line, I can't argue with what's behind the motive behind the bill that also lines up with what we consider one of the most important priorities that we have. The question, I suppose, always is it necessary to legislate that? It certainly, in my mind, is a strong statement of support for what I consider one of the most important things that we're to accomplish.
Just a brief follow-up. Some of the discussion in the floor debate was around whether there was a need for the bill. And I'm still struggling with that piece from where I sit, voted in opposition. We'll just stay tuned.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, Senator Nelson.
Thank you. Thank you for coming all the way from Pendleton. It's good to see you. I'm having really struggling with this accountability issue, and you're okay. Talking about that. I mean, it seems to me that the accountability at the university level president, that's probably the most important, and I have the same issue with K-12, too. You know, the most important people are... Yep. You know, the teachers on the classroom, and you know, and when you centralize accountability, one, it's expensive, and two, you know, what does it really accomplish?
Well, you know, one of the things that I would, Senator Nelson, I would struggle to say Senator Nelson. The thing I would refer you to would be North Dakota has done a terrific job in developing the performance measures, which is very helpful in determining whether or not we're doing the right thing, whether our efforts are being focused appropriately, focused on things such as cost per student, but also even other intangibles such as satisfaction, the student satisfaction with what the education they've received, as well as the employer satisfaction with the students that are being graduated. There is, in my mind, I understand it is expensive, and the question is always, what do you get back in return for those performance measurements? The legislature is asking from us increasing information to make sure the money is being well spent at the university level. You can't answer those questions in a complex setting such as our universities without the good manpower that can look at the system overall to determine whether we're delivering to those measures. I think it's a very good thing that the legislature is looking to make certain that the investment of additional dollars returns a product that is worthwhile and is worth that investment. And the only way that can be done is through good systems that analyze appropriate outcomes and the progress toward making those outcomes. And it's, the question really is a philosophical one. Do you want to have seven independent universities, each setting their own goals, which we are now, we've delegated to the maximum extent, I believe, possible, and to take into account those efficiencies, but yet at the same time have a central body that can make certain that these seven units are moving together in a coordinated manner and accomplishing what we want to have done. And the only way we can do that is to establish performance measures, which require some central administration.
Thank you.
I'm, well, This is almost like trying to analyze the beauty of a picture in many ways. If, you know, philosophically, you kind of line up on one side of the fence or the other.
Thank you. Any additional questions?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Senator Walker, then Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you. I wanted to follow up on what Senator Gordley was getting at, because Mr. Lawrence and I spoke this morning in my office, and I think what Senate Bill 747 wanted to do was, you know, I think there's some concern about whether we should expand or contract our university system. And we really want the board to focus on that discussion. And because I think some folks may be getting ahead of the curve, and some of us may be behind it, and some of us aren't sure where that curve is going. And so I think we just wanted really the board to have some direction about having that discussion. And could you just, it seems to me that you addressed that in, when you discussed the long-range planning aspect of your committee. And I'm not going to put you in a spot. I don't want to put you in a spot, but I understand Mr. Von Schlegel is chairing that portion, and you will be addressing those issues.
Yes. Yes, absolutely, we will. And it's, you know, there's an issue of sustainability of our education system. We continue to increase enrollment, and we expect the universities to accomplish and deliver a good educational product with resources that are stretched ever so thin. And I think that a long-range planning effort needs to face this directly to determine what is a sustainable level of enrollment that we can achieve, given resources we can reasonably expect to have in the future.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Lawrence. And that's a very good answer.
Senator Whitsitt.
Chair Devlin, I just want to take the opportunity to thank you for your service. And I think you really are leading this effort in the right direction. I think that for the first time in my memory, we're seeing universities actually striving to work together and to create a common product, not only universities, but the community colleges. I hear, rather than having individual entities that are competing with one another on the competition's a good thing in the private sector, but if we're going to fund it, it doesn't make sense to duplicate. So I think you're doing a good job. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Lorenzen, there is sort of a different take on the question that you were asked by Senator Walker. I think the issue is the sustainability of the system in terms of the resources that are available, but I think bigger issue is what is the need, what are the needs of the state long term. If we were to say that we can't sustain our current system, but our current system would not produce the workforce that we would ultimately need in the state to retain a vital economy, that would be a very sad commentary, if you might want to comment.
It would be. It'd be terribly sad. You know, and in many respects, you can look at what's happening in Washington right now. They have a magnificent master plan that has identified clearly how many students they anticipate will move through the community college system up to the university system. They have now, just almost abruptly, I hate to admit it, but my older daughter's at the University of Washington. I hope that she would have been a beaver and follow her dad's footsteps, but she didn't. But I follow it through. They have retreated from that commitment to accept those folks coming up through the community colleges because of lack of funding. I don't want to see that, but I think one of the most important things is that with the long-range planning is that we clearly identify those educational needs. I think right now in my mind, and I'm speaking as probably as an advocate for community colleges in many respects, we have a tremendous need for nursing, nurses. We have a tremendous body of talented people who want to become nurses, but we don't have the facilities to deliver those educational services. This is just one example of what I think can be accomplished a long-range plan that analyzes carefully those needs and how we go about meeting them. I'm hoping that through such an effort, if we can do it clearly and gain the confidence of those who review it, we might be able to move the general populace into greater support for higher education to meet those needs.
Thank you. Any additional questions? Thank you. So people won't be too concerned about time frame. My three representatives on the committee have all volunteered to stay, and the speaker has okayed them to stay until about 10:25, unless they have to be taken for a call before then. So we have more time. Mr. Fatima.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the board, members of the committee. My name is Sosro Fatimi, and I'm president of Eastern Oregon University, and I'm here this morning to provide you a brief report on the status of higher education in rural Oregon. As you can see from the slide, the overall percentage of adults in Oregon with a higher education degree is 25.1%. However, that's not distributed evenly throughout different counties, and a handful of counties are above that average, and most counties, all of them in rural Oregon, are below the average. The overall average for rural counties is 15.2%, in contrast with 25.1% of adults for the state as a whole. Next slide shows the four regional universities which are primarily responsible for providing the services that rural Oregon needs to improve the attainment of students in terms of college education. As bad as the problem is in terms of disparity, where overall 25% of adults have a college degree in Oregon and in Eastern and rural Oregon, that's 15%, the trend is even worse. If you look at the next group of population, college-age population, those who are between 18 and 24, statewide, 30% are in college. For rural Oregon, that's 14.6%. In other words, whereas the state's current, as we see in the next slide, the state's current rate of college attainment is 25%, and the next generation, those who are in college age, 30% are in college. For rural Oregon, the trend is negative. We are moving in the wrong direction. Right now, about 15% have a college degree of adults. In the next cohort of population, 14.6% are in college. And if that trend continues, obviously, eventually, the percentage of adults with college degree in rural Oregon will continue to diminish. There are a number of reasons for the disparity. Generally, as a former economist, I can say that overall, rural areas do have a lower college attainment. That's not a surprise, and that's not unique to Oregon. But the disparity is significantly higher than that would indicate. Part of the problem is access. There is no such thing as commuting to college in rural Oregon. The distances are far too long. If you look at the case of Eastern Oregon University, for example, we are located in La Grande. Of the counties that we serve, none falls within commuting distance. The closest city would be Baker City, that's 45 miles. Given the road conditions in the winter, etc., you really cannot expect a student to commute for 4 years to get a college degree, and almost every day of the week during that period. And that's the closest. Pendleton is over 50, and then you get as far as over 200 miles, which obviously are not commuting distance. So access is a problem. The second one is cost. Cost of higher education has been going up, will probably continue to go up. And if you look at cost as a percentage of family income or per capita income, there again you see a tremendous disparity between Oregon as a whole and rural Oregon. The cost of higher education as a percentage of personal or family income is about 25% statewide. For rural Oregon, it's 34%. However you look at it, spending 34% of one's income to go to college isn't going to work. and it's not manageable, and therefore a lot of people are not going to college. The third reason is a combination of sociological and socioeconomic factors, ranging from first-generation students or potential students. It's much more difficult for a family in which neither parent has a college degree to be convincing to the children that they need to go to college. I've had a number of discussions with high school students, and inevitably, for those who would be first-generation college students, the argument becomes, well, my father didn't go to college, he's doing well, why do I need to use their language, waste 4 years and go to college? I don't need it. My father did well. The first time I heard that, it really caught me by surprise, and it took me a while before I came out with a sort of an answer. And the answer is, well, when your father graduated from high school, a high school degree was a guarantee of a decent earning for the rest of his life. When you graduate, that won't be the case. More and more jobs are going to require a college degree, and if you don't have it, you won't get in to do well. Still, that's a problem. I think the universities need to be more active in that area of helping the parents in that argument. There is no peer pressure to go to college. Certainly not in the rural parts of the country. If anything, the peer pressure is the other way around. Another very important socioeconomic factor is that the economy of the region, rural Oregon, has changed quite a bit. It used to be resource-based, and mills and other organizations paid fairly well salaries, decent salaries, and a high school degree was enough. The mills are no longer there. Whereas the economy has changed, and the mills aren't there, and the kids who are in high school now need a college degree, the culture hasn't changed. The belief still is that, well, my father didn't get a college degree, or my mother didn't get a college degree, why do I need it? These are some long-term problems, and we need to address those if we are going to solve the problem and create more of a parity among the high school graduates going to college in rural Oregon, as well as with the rest of the state. We need to have an expanded high school outreach program. The current program that most of us have, basically we go to high schools, we talk to seniors, in our case we try to sell them the idea of how wonderful Eastern Oregon University is, and try to attract them there. The problem is that if you're successful, in effect, we are stealing them from somewhere else, because we are addressing at this point 1 out of 8 high school graduates who have already decided to go to college in rural Oregon. The other 7 out of 8 are not being addressed when we talk to seniors. It's too late. We need to talk to in fact, we have started talking at Eastern Oregon University. We have started talking to 8th graders and 9th graders and to some extent 7th graders. And when we talk with them, we don't talk to them about Eastern Oregon University and all the advantages of going there. We talk to them about the advantages of going to college. Now, we're not entirely philanthropic. We know that if we convince 100 students to go to college, 95 of them will come to Eastern for geographic reasons. But nevertheless, the argument is a lot more effective when it's not self-serving. We can talk to them about the fact that, and the argument is very simple. We tell them, look, you're an 8th grader. You are going to high school next year. 4 years later, you are going to get a high school degree. All we are asking you at this point is not to make the decision that you are not going to college at this point. Take a few college prep courses. Take a few AP courses. They won't kill you. And we know that nobody takes college algebra for the fun of it. But take it. If anything, you learn a little. When you're a senior, then decide whether you want to go to college or not. If you decide that you're not going to college, you haven't lost anything. But if you decide to go to college, 4 years later, you enter a labor pool for which unemployment is significantly below the overall average. But more importantly, your lifelong earnings will be enhanced by almost $1 million. And I think maybe the rest of the argument is not understandable by a 14-year-old, but the million-dollar part is. And I think we are able to convince some to at least think about going to college earlier than normal. We also need to make it doable for them. We need to start offering college courses at high school campuses. We started doing this year at one of our school districts, and we plan to increase that significantly to five or six districts, and hopefully by fall of 06 we will cover all the regions that we serve. Part of the problem with students not going to college is for lack of a better word, intimidation factor. We have schools in our region where the total number of students in one is 19. If one graduates from school with 19 students, where everybody is related, or everybody knows everybody else, and then having to uproot oneself and go to the big city of La Grande and the huge campus of Eastern Oregon University with 2,000 or 3,000 students, that's intimidating. And so what we're doing is we're trying to get them to visit the campus during their high school year, so that when they finish, they won't have any at least fear of getting there. And finally, we need to increase financial aid. That still is a problem, despite everything else. Financial aid is always a problem. We're convinced that if these steps are continued and if they are expanded to include different counties of rural Oregon, that in 10 years the percentage of high school graduates from rural Oregon going to college will be equal to or maybe even higher than the state average. With that optimistic, maybe naive observation, I'll conclude and I'll be happy to respond to any questions.
Any questions? Senator Nelson.
One of the things that you did was you basically offered five full-ride scholarships to winners of science fair or something. Would you like to tell that story of actually how many of those kids are going to take care of? I think that underscores your point.
We had a robotic competition on our campus a few months ago, and mostly high school freshmen from several school districts participated in that. And at the end of the day, it was a day-long competition. At the end of the day, we offered four-year scholarships, tuition waivers, to the winners, to the six winners. And later on, when I was talking, we had a small reception to recognize the student. I was talking to their parents and the superintendent of the school. And he said that of the six, three had absolutely no intention of going to college. But that competition and the scholarship changed their mind and are looking at different universities to go to college. When I was talking to the kids themselves, several indicated that changed their life. And it was very interesting. One of the parents really was so emotional. He almost was in tears when he was thanking me for his scholarship. And he said, look, without this, my kid would have never gone to college. So we can affect them, and I think we can encourage more of them. And one advantage of that particular scholarship is that not only gets more kids to go to college, gets them to go to college in the needed areas of sciences. And that's one of the shortcomings of the labor pool in rural Oregon, that there are not enough people with science majors. So it helps in more than one way.
Any additional? President Fatemi, one of the things about cost being a factor, it's kind of a hidden issue. It's just sort of common sense, I guess. Because your students can't commute, I have many students in the Portland metropolitan area that still stay at home in their first couple of years because they can commute, so their costs are less. Also, not saying that there are not jobs in La Grande, but their jobs are not as plentiful as they would be in a metropolitan area. And so students trying to find additional part-time jobs to meet their costs, it's probably more limited also, I would guess. Would that be a fair observation? Or
Yes.
I mean, you have work study, but
but that's about it.
Well, the question of access, one way of addressing it, and we started doing that 25 years ago, is to have distance education at least for the early on, and then students would transfer to the campus. In fact, about one-third of our students are distance ed students, and we go to them to take the educational opportunities to them. That has helped a lot, and I think many of them after a year or two, the traditional students after a year or two do transfer back to either Eastern Oregon or another university. Several of them are, or many of them transfer to other universities. The question of the second part of your question, Mr. Sherman, in terms of whether we should create the jobs before we educate them, or whether we educate them before.
It's not so much, Mr. President, it's not so much create the jobs, it's just that the sort of creative things that students do in some other areas to try to make ends meet are just not as possible.
That's very true. I agree.
And so.
No question, you know, the number of part-time jobs in La Grande are very few and far in between, so it's not easy for students to move.
Any additional questions? Representative March.
Thank you. Well, following up on that point, are the jobs, say the part-time jobs or the seasonal jobs, they're more summer-oriented as well. So even if you shifted so that people could access it better because the roads were better in the summer, they would be out working.
Very good. Very good point and very true. We have, of all the universities I've been at, we offer fewer summer school classes than any on a percentage basis. And that's exactly because of your point that students need to work either in family farm or just to earn enough money to be able to continue their education. We do not have a large summer school program precisely for that reason.
Thank you.
Anything additional? Thank you both very much for coming.
Thank you.
Chancellor, could you come forward and I think it's impractical to start your presentation now, but I would probably like to have you meet with Mr. Bender afterwards, and we could revise your schedule over the next 2 days to see how we can fit everything in. We will need 5 minutes on Thursday for an unrelated item where the chair has to pay penance. So...
I tried to make sure.
Mr. Chancellor.
Mr. Chair, thank you. For the record, George Pernsteiner, Acting Chancellor. I appreciate the opportunity to be here. I certainly will work with Mr. Bender after this is concluded. If you'd like, I could do a little sum up now or not. That's your pleasure.
Okay. If you wanted to take 2 or 3 minutes and sum up, that would be fine. And actually give us basically an end to today's, and we'll start tomorrow fresh.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had the opportunity last night to attend an event up in Portland and happened to be seated next to one of my former students, which is always a sort of a mixed blessing because they remember too much about what you may have said at one time in your past. And she reminded me that I never stick to scripts very well, so perhaps that's a good thing at this point in the proceedings. You've heard from the president of our board, Henry Lorenzen. You've heard from President Fatemi. And I think a couple of the things that I'd like to draw from what they said, in fact, would wrap up today fairly well. And that is the Board of Higher Education has a vision. And that vision is that all Oregonians, regardless of where they live, regardless of how much money they make, will have an opportunity to participate fully in a 21st century information-based global economy. We've talked about that before, but that really animates our board and it animates our presidents, and I think just seeing some of the things which they have presented to you show that is a very heartfelt view on their parts. the board has presented to you and the governor has presented to you a budget that is organized around access, affordability, excellence, and economic development. And all of those things will, in fact, be organizing principles in 07, 09, and then probably every budget that you see from higher education from henceforward. The difference, I think, is the focus that you are seeing now by this board, by these presidents, in cooperation with their community college and K-12 educational partners, to focus on student success and to figure out how it is that we are going to provide all Oregon students with an opportunity to participate in a 21st century that will demand a higher level of education than we've had to have. And that is a new challenge for us. In the past, we have focused on whether or not we were educating the students we received and educating them quickly and well. And we were doing better and better on those things. But we didn't look at the students who never came. And I think it's incumbent on us now to look at all of the students in the state, regardless of whether they're enrolled in our system or not, in order to figure out what kind of economy and society we're going to have. That's the kind of planning that Chair Lorenzen was talking about. Those are the kinds of things that we will be focused on as we move forward. Yes, there are warning signs. We are very worried. We know that a smaller percentage of students are going to college now than went last year. We know that. President Fatemi showed you that in Eastern Oregon, it's worse than the state average. And in fact, it's not even, not just less than last year, it's less than the workforce is right now. We know that that's not sustainable if we want our own citizens to be successful in the 21st century. We know that. The planning which the board will undertake in the next biennium will begin to work with the other educational segments to bring that together. We have NF and affordability. We know that too. And I think that the discussion which you have had about the Opportunity Grant begins to frame some of the issues around how we will provide access to quality higher education to all Oregonians, regardless of whether or not they have the financial means. The fact that only about half the applicants for the Oregon Opportunity Grant this biennium could even get one, not because they made too much money, but because we ran out of money, is indicative of the fact that the need is much greater than we've been able to address. We've talked with you about low faculty salaries, again, a sustainability issue. We've talked with you about the increasing number of students per faculty member, again, a sustainability issue. The reliance on part-time faculty, the deferred maintenance, all of those things are warning signs. But we know how to do things, and we know how to do them well. And I think ETIC demonstrated that. With that investment of state money, matched by private money, we were able to do something Washington could not do. Henry talked to you about Washington. Let me tell you something Washington could not do. They could not and did not increase the number of both students and graduates in engineering and computer science. We did. We did. Because we made the investment, we knew how to make that work. And I think the kinds of things that you see in this budget will do that again. We are trying to improve with our community college and K-12 partners. You've seen the Oregon Transfer Module. You've seen the Atlas system. All of those things are aimed at helping students through to degree, making it clearer, making it easier. But we can't do it without investment. We need additional investment from the state. That's what the budget is about. And at this point, I think I'll be quiet because it's almost 10:30. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And with that, we will close the hearing for today, and I will see you all in the morning.